Well, George Michael Cohan certainly was a showman, one of the most successful, flamboyant and gifted showmen who ever eased capital out of a backer's back pockets. And yet, to include him in a review of showmen does seem a trifle strange. The reason is that whichever pigeonhole you select for Cohan, he refuses to fit it. The pigeonhole comes apart at the seams, and the personality of Cohan goes flying off as elusive as ever. What was George Michael Cohan? Well, he was an actor, a dancer, a singer, a producer, a director, a composer, a lyricist, a playwright, and a designer. Probably, if the statistics were all computed accurately, we'd find that Cohan holds all the records. Certainly, he produced over 80 Broadway shows. Certainly, he had one of the longest stage careers of any musical figure. Stage debut, 1885 at the age of 7, and last starring role in a Rodgers and Hart musical, 1937. The years spanned by his prolific life saw the evolution of America from horse and buggy to intercontinental flights. From the America of Mark Twain, through the big city of O. Henry's sentimental tales, to the harsher dreams of Damon Runyon. And throughout that period, you could define Cohan as a traditionalist. The greatest figure of the American musical theater before he was 30, he stood after that for the old style, the old values, for the buccaneer of genius against the combines and the syndicates and the unions and uniformity. He was a rogue elephant, and sometimes he was a rogue too. But the world of the theater has never forgotten him or his songs.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy!
Yankee Doodle Doo, or die.
I'm a real live nephew of my Uncle Sam's, born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. She's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle went to London just to ride the ponies. I am that Yankee Doodle boy. I'm a Yankee Doodle dandy. Yes, sir, friends. I'm a Yankee Doodle do or die. You know what, too? I'm a real live nephew of my Uncle Sam's. You know why? Because I was born on the 4th of July. And let me tell you, I've got me a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. Oh, she's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle went to London just to ride the ponies. I am a Yankee Doodle.
As a matter of fact, George M. Cohan wasn't the Yankee Doodle boy. Well, not quite. If he'd been perfectly truthful in that lyric, he'd have written, born on the 3rd of July. But for the sake of 24 hours, Georgie rigged the facts to give himself an excuse to drape himself in the national flag, and over the years, the stars and stripes were to become Cohan's private overcoat. So perhaps we can forgive him that first excess. The Cohans were strolling players, a family act, the real-life originals of the old born-in-a-trunk fairy story. If the kids in the Cohan family weren't actually born in a trunk, well, they often slept in one. Ma and Pa would distribute the children in drawers and trunks in the dressing room while they went out on the stage and did their stuff. Although by the time he was 7, George was out there on stage doing it with them. He was a bumptious, cocky boy, and if we examine Cohan's musical work, we find two elements that dominate. The first was patriotism, and the second was a certain kind of stage song where everybody pretends that Broadway, instead of just being a very long street that doesn't go anywhere, is a romantic highway packed with stage door johnnies and champagne. The idea was really created by Cohan, and this is the song he created it with.
Give my regards to Broadway, remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the gang at 42nd Street that I will soon be there. Whisper of how I'm yearning to mingle with the old-time throng. Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
Did you ever see two Yankees part upon a foreign shore? the good ship's just about to start for old New York once more. With tear-dimmed eye, they say goodbye, they're friends without a doubt. When the man on the pier shouts, let them clear, as the ship strides out.
Give my regards to Broadway, remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the gang at 42nd Street that I will soon be there. Whisper of how I'm yearning to mingle with the old-time throng. Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
One of the great songs of its era, but it turned up in a show that was fraught with possible disaster right from the very first rehearsal. The trouble was that Cohan and Sam Harris, the ex-cough drop salesman with whom he was associated at the time, were not only partners, but also a pair of beautifully matched liars who succeeded in taking each other for a ride. Years later, Cohan described what happened in the preparation for the show, which was called Little Johnny Jones.
This Harris man, by the way, is a very surprising person. Full of surprises. I know he's handed me many a surprise. I don't mean by that I didn't know he was always a great showman, a great judge of plays and all that sort of thing. But I mean he's really a surprising man. I remember the first time he surprised me. Of course, when Sam and I went into business together, I naturally thought he had a lot of money. We didn't talk about that till we were in the middle of rehearsals for our first show. And then when he told me he was broke, that was my first surprise. And he seemed just as surprised as when I told him I was broke, too. And the members of the company were very much surprised when they found out we were both broke.
As the modern cast member might react to that, charming. But somehow, Cohan and Harris cajoled and bribed and bullied and persuaded everyone to turn up on the night of the 7th of November, 1904, at the Liberty Theatre. Everyone, including the audience, who had never quite seen anything like it. One other number from the show is still remembered with affection by the musician, Dr. Robert Russell Bennett.
I was conducting the orchestra and came in. He used to sit with a chair backwards. He'd sit on the chair and the back would be toward the audience. He'd put his two arms on the back of the chair and say, life's a funny proposition after all. That was one of his big things. He really has the house in stitches. He's a cute man.
At which point we come up against the great bugbear of musical research. Dr. Robert Russell Bennett says Cohan was a cute man who had the house in stitches. And so he must have been, and did. Everyone can't have been wrong about him, but there exists a recording of Cohan himself performing the song that Bennett mentions, Life's a Funny Proposition. And frankly, it's not half as funny as the style of Cohan's delivery. The date is the 7th of November, 1904. Cohan sits on an empty stage, leans over the back of the chair, the orchestra creeps in, and a little bit of theatre history is made.
Did you ever sit and ponder, sit and wonder, sit and think why we're here and what this life is all about? It's a problem that has driven many brainy men to drink. It's the weirdest thing they've tried to figure out. About 1,000 different theories the scientists can show, but never yet have proved a reason why. With all we've thought and all we're taught, why all we seem to know is we're born, live a while, then we die. Life's a very funny proposition after all. Imagination, jealousy, hypocrisy, gall. 3 meals a day, a whole lot to say. When you haven't got the coin, you're always in the way. Everybody's fighting, we wend our way along. Every fellow claims the other fellow's in the wrong. Hurried and worried until we're buried, there's no curtain call. life a very funny proposition after all. When things are coming easy and when luck is with a man, then life to him is sunshine everywhere. Then the fates blow rather breezy, they quite upset a plan, and he'll cry that life's a burden hard to bear. Though today may be a day of smiles, tomorrow's still in doubt. What brings me joy may bring you care and woe. We're born to die, but don't know why or what it's all about. The more we try to learn, the less we know. Life's a very funny proposition, you can bet. And no one's ever solved the problem properly as yet. Young for a day, then old and gray, like the rose that buds and blooms and fades and falls away. Losing health in search of wealth, as through this dream we tour, everything's a guess and nothing's absolutely sure. Battle's exciting, fate we're fighting, until the curtains fall. Life's a very funny proposition after all.
New York Mirror, 8th November, 1904. It is a pity that Mr. Cohen has decided to take such a serious view of his abilities. Little Johnny Jones is a musical offense, an ill-assorted combination, the first unfortunate attempt at musical melodrama.
Cohan never forgave any critic for anything and conducted a running war with them for the rest of his life. They attacked him for the coarseness of his taste, and he retaliated by attacking them for the coarseness of theirs. The dispute was never resolved, but it came to its fiery climax in 1906, when Cohan wrote, produced, directed, and starred in the second of his great one-man triumphs, called, well, why bother to give the title when there's a Cohan song to give it for us?
Short time it takes, what a difference it makes in the ways of the people and things. Oh, what a fine bunch of farmers. Oh, what a room atmosphere. They have whiskers like hay, and imagine Broadway only 45 minutes from here.
Only 45 Minutes from Broadway opened on Broadway on the 1st of January 1906 and was the greatest sensation seen in the musical theater for 40 years. The female lead was the one-time burlesque star, Faye Templeton.
Oh, what a fine bunch of farmers. Oh, what a room atmosphere. They have whiskers like hay and imagine Broadway only 45 minutes.
The only groups who disapproved of 45 Minutes from Broadway were the critics, some of whom still couldn't accept the brash Cohan as a true gentleman, and the good citizens of New Rochelle who objected to the way that Cohan had poked fun at their community in his show. On New Year's Day, 1906, the day of the show's New York opening, the New Rochelle Chamber of Commerce called an emergency meeting session and passed several highly eccentric resolutions.
A. To institute a boycott. B. To denounce the play as libelous to their community and its inhabitants.
The world at large took no notice of New Rochelle, and the crowds kept rolling up even as the critics rolled away.
The theater, 2nd January 1906. The show is rubbish. Mr. Cohen has little art and is trying to catch only the unthinking crowd.
In his defense, Cohan gave an interview to the Chicago Post in which he suggested that there were more ways than one of composing a play and that he knew most of them.
I don't make plays according to Hoyle. I can't sit down and deliberately make a skeleton of what it's going to be. My plan is to collect a half a dozen characters, acquaint them with each other, and let them run along. I write my plays after midnight. I get back to my apartment after the theater and have a pound of beefsteak, fried potatoes, and coffee. Then I write steadily till 9 in the morning.
The audiences neither cared about Cohan's methods nor the complaints of his critics. All they wanted were tuneful songs and amusing characters, and these Cohan gave them in abundance. And in only 45 minutes from Broadway, he gave them also one of the most famous mother-love, tear-jerking, Oedipus complexities ever put to music. Today, the song remains as powerful an appealer to basic emotions as it did back in the Edwardian days. Strictly speaking, Only 45 Minutes from Broadway was not a Cohan production at all. Officially, it was for those two gentlemen so aptly named by nature as to reflect their true personalities, Messrs. Claw and Erlanger, as if to say Hun and Visigoth or Blood and Sabretooth. But, in effect, Cohan supervised most of the actual strategy. For his other 1906 bombshell, he again turned to Sam Harris for production help. This time, it was America that got most of the treatment. The story goes, and Cohan took care to circulate it, that one day in a funeral parade he saw a Civil War veteran carrying a tattered Stars and Stripes. Cohan leapt into the breach with one of the most vulgar and effective uses of patriotism seen on any stage since the old song about By Jingo that English audiences had thrilled to and which had added a new word to the language. Cohan's new show, George Washington Jr., didn't add any new words to the language, but it certainly caused a flurry of the old ones. The critics certainly didn't at all approve of the use of the Stars and Stripes as a device to milk the suckers.
Theatre Magazine, February 1906. Cohan's ideas are good, but his manners atrocious. He is thoroughly flippant and common. Not vulgar, but the spirit of juvenescent enthusiasm is so assertive that the actor has it all his own way. The profanation of the national flag is horrifying. Life Magazine, February 1906.
Mr. Cohan is apparently quite a young man. A large part of his stock trade is an absolute lack of bashfulness. His latest hero is a vulgar, cheap, blatant, ill-mannered, flashily dressed, insolent smart aleck who, for some reason unexplainable on any basis of common sense, good taste, or even ordinary decency, appeals to the imagination of large American audiences. The rounds of applause which greet the efforts of this offensive personality must convey to the minds of ignorant boys a depraving ideal for their inspiration and imitation.
The two blasts which greeted George Washington, Jr., the blast of approval from audiences who delighted in the vulgar, cheap, blatant, ill-mannered, flashily dressed, insolent young smart aleck, and the blast of fastidious critical dismay inspired Cohan to do a most uncharacteristic thing. He replied to his critics in print. He casually and even insolently dismissed their rebukes, justifying himself on the grounds of infallibility. It was a grandiose gesture to which there was no answer, and it was to be the last time in his life that Cohan ever paid the press the compliment of taking any notice.
For the benefit of some damn fools I've met, let me say that my success comes from the fact that I know and have studied the business in which I managed to knock out a very good livelihood. I write my own songs because I write better songs than anybody else I know of. I publish these songs because they bring greater royalties than any other class music sold in this country. I write my own plays because I have not yet read or seen plays from the pens of other authors that seem as good as the plays I write. I produce my own plays because I think I'm as good a theatrical manager as any other man in this line. I dance because I know I'm the best dancer in the country. I sing because I can sing my own songs better than any other man on a stage. I play the leading parts in most of my plays because I think I'm the best actor available. I pay myself the biggest salary ever paid a song and dance comedian because I know I deserve it. But believe me, kind reader, when I say I am not an egotist.
Bonnie, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hoist the flag and let her fly, like true heroes do or die. Pack your little kit, show your grit, do your bit. Soldiers from the ranks to the towns and the tanks. Make your mother proud of you, and to liberty be true. Over there, send the word over there. The Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming. The drums, drum, tumming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer. Send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over. And we won't be back till it's over, over there. You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag. And forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of that I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a post or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on that grand old flag.
There's a feeling comes a-stealing, and it sets my brain a-reeling when I'm listening to the music of a military band.
Any tune like Yankee Doodle simply sets me off my noodle. It's that patriotic something that no one can understand. Red, white, and blue, I am for you. Honest, you're a grand old flag. You're a grand old flag. You're a high-flying flag. And forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love. The home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats blue, like the red, white, and blue. When it's there.
By 1908, although he didn't know it, Cohan was nearing the end of his most fruitful period as a songwriter and showman. The shows would continue to pour out, but from now on, Cohan, his energies spread thin between his various functions, began to write not quite such memorable lyrics and not quite such rousing melodies. Well, what about his sketch writing? Now, perhaps in this exchange from one of his early pieces, The Governor's Song, we'll find the authentic flavor.
You're Dickie Dixon's wife?
If you're her husband, how can she be my husband's wife?
Your husband's wife?
If you're her husband and she's my husband's wife, then you must be my husband's wife's husband. I'm going to protect my husband. Your wife shall never harm my husband, even though she is his wife.
I wish I could wake up. She threatens to kill me. Now she's got another husband and he's got another wife. I wonder what relation I am to my wife's other husband's other wife.
Well, that was George Cohan's style, and he kept to it all his working life. In 1908, he presented something called 50 Miles from Boston, a title that suggests that already he was becoming a slave to his own conventions, because, after all, 50 miles from Boston isn't so very different from 45 minutes from Broadway. The show isn't now regarded as one of the vintage Cohan affairs, but it does have one song that's managed to survive, at least in America, if not in Britain. The small-town setting of the show, largely autobiographical, had a charm which hit the big city audiences between wind and water. It also contained an example of Cohan's generosity to the older generation of performer. One of his great idols was Ned Harrigan, a master of musical farce. So Cohan put a character called Harrigan into his new show, with the following result.
For I'm just as proud of my name, you see, as an emperor, czar, or a king could be. The ladies and babies are fond of me. I'm fond of them too in return, you see. H-A-R-R-I, G-A-N, spelled Harrigan. Proud of all the Irish blood is in me. A gibble a man can say a word again me. H-A-R-R-I, G-A-N, yes, see. It's a name that to shame never has been connected with. Never has been connected with Harrigan.
Mulligan.
Harrigan.
Mulligan.
Harrigan. Mulligan. Harrigan. Mulligan.
50 Miles from Boston was presented in 1908, right at the heart of Cohan's golden period as the American theater's golden boy. But when you look down the list of his songs, the surviving items suddenly stop around this time. He still had his biggest single success to come, although not his best song. But as the world moved towards the Great War and the modern age, Cohan's style became a shade quaint, although his power as a showman went, at least for a while, from strength to strength. On Christmas Day, 1914, Cohan was celebrating in a very eccentric way, opening in a show called Hello Broadway at the Astor Theatre. There were the usual things in the show, a Stars and Stripes routine, and yet another Broadway song, I Wanted to Come to Broadway. One of the cast members was Peggy Wood.
I got quite a good part in that. Only this week, I began to think of a song in that show. I was doing a piece about my troubles with the dentist, something about root canals. Well, the roots kind of bothered me as he talked to me, but canals, oh, that started all kinds of stories in my mind because I'd been much associated with allusions to that. But one of the things that came that I didn't know I remembered at all was a song from Hello Broadway. And Cohan had written a song for a rather pleasantly blousy lady that was called The Eyrie. And it goes, let me see. Down by the Eyrie, there we awaits my pal. Though the days are long and dreary, he declares he'll ne'er grow weary. Poor John O'Leary, I'm afraid you've lost your gal, for she left you flat, my dearie, on the Erie Canal. Was from Hello Broadway, and he also had a compere with him, you see, which was William Collier. And between the two of them, they would sometimes get on the stage, but the two of them had laughed so much at each other's jokes that they hardly bothered with the audience, but they never really forgot them. I won't be so unkind as to say that, because they were wonderful at that. Then they did a song and dance together, soft shoe dancing, both of them, and it was marvelous. I used to stand in the wings and watch him all the time. He could do anything, of course, Mr. Cohan. Soft shoe dancing, to lyric writing, to songs, to anything.
In fact, from now on, his connections with popular songs was more and more a question of other people's rather than of his own. In 1921, for instance, he became involved with perhaps the greatest songwriter America has so far produced. Composer Fred Coutts explains.
He became associated with Sam Harris, and it was Conan Harris. And then they found this fella, Irving Berlin, and they built a theater called the Music Box.
All alone, I'm so all alone. There is no one else but you.
Irving Berlin's Alone must have struck the composer of Give My Regards to Broadway as a trifle, shall we say, modern. But it wasn't only music that was moving too fast for Cohan in the 1920s. Labor relations inside the theater were also getting a little bit too advanced for his taste. In the great equity dispute of the period, Cohan alienated himself from the entire acting profession with his obstinate feudal attitude towards employment. It's an ironic thing that in this dispute, it was Sam Harris, the producer, who sided with the performers, and Cohan, the performer, who sided with the managements. But then, Cohan was just about the most pugnacious man the American theater ever knew. And one of his songs actually included jibes against one of his professional rivals, the showman Charles Frohman. And in introducing that song, the actress Peggy Wood reminds us that the rank and file of Broadway never really forgave Cohan his anti-union stand.
He was a very, very interesting man. And the only thing I ever had against him was that he was against the Actors' Equity Association in the beginning. And he wasn't going to have anything to do with them. He snarled at them. Well, he ate those words. I think that he was a little megalomania in that. He was wrong, but he had taken a stand and he had to stick by it. But he backed down when the time came. He said he would never have anybody in the theater again. Never. Of course he didn't. He was right smack back in the business that he knew.
Charles,
Charlie Frohman left the town, starring Isabella Brown in a new Augustus Thomas play. He took the troupe to Hazelnut, way down in Connecticut, just to break it in for old Broadway. When the train arrived with all, the manager who ran the hall met them at the depot with a frown. Said he, as he put out his hand, "I hear you haven't got a band. The folks expect a street parade in town." Frohman laughed and bowed his head. The local manager, he said, "You won't do any business if you haven't got a band. The folks expect a street parade and uniforms are grand. So the whole profession, well, it may sound funny, but it's just the thing that'll get the money when you play an old New England one-night stand in Connecticut. Sir Henry Irving played the town, starved to death last fall. Old High Henry came along, and he packed him to the wall. The town is sad, but the house is sadder, but it wouldn't make a difference if you lose out sadder. Well, you won't do any business if you haven't got a band." The manager, he said, "You folks should get some bills like Wharton folks, some bills that show the chorus girls in sight. Or bills where someone's got a knife, gonna take the hero's life, boss Bates packed them in here 20 nights." When to the hotel Frohman got, the clerk was Johnny on the spot, said he, "You'll pay your bill now, understand. You see, we never take a chance. We charge the actors in advance. That is a false unless they've got a band." Frohman laughed and held his breath. The clerk says, "You'll all starve to death. You won't do any business if you haven't got a band. The folks expect a street parade and uniforms so grand. To the whole profession, well, it may sound funny, but it's just a thing that'll get the money when you play an old New England one-night stand. In Connecticut, Sir Henry Irving played the town, and he starved to death last fall. Old High Henry came along, and he packed him to the wall. The town is sad, but your house is sadder, and it wouldn't make a difference if you lose out sadder. Well, you won't do any business if you haven't got a band."
Having gone to war with his fellow performers, Cohan now proceeded to go to war with his fellow composers and lyricists. The occasion was a 1937 production called I'd Rather Be Right, in which Cohan, now an aged figure from the past, made a triumphant Broadway comeback as a leading man. In fact, so high was his prestige by now that when King George VI and Queen Elizabeth visited the United States in 1939, it was Cohan and Gertrude Lawrence who were chosen to represent the performing arts.
Thank you very much, Miss Lawrence.
And thank you, Mr. George M. Cohan. Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce Mr. George M. Cohan, leading figure of the American theater and composer of the justly famous Over There? Mr. Cohan.
Well, thank you again, Miss Lawrence, and your fellow countrymen who have participated in this tribute. Speaking as an American and as a representative of the American theater, may I propose a toast to the health of His Majesty King George VI.
And God bless the Queen.
A toast to a fine young man, to a very lovely lady, to as charming a couple as ever graced these shores. Your visit here has brought happiness to millions of Americans and has tightened the bond of friendship between our two great nations. The men and women of the American theater join their English cousins in a salute to their fine young king, their lovely queen. Bon voyage, your majesties. God bless you both.
Champagne corks and all. You hear that? Well, that was very cozy, but behind the scenes of I'd Rather Be Right, blue murders were going on. The trouble was that Cohan regarded the composer and the lyricist of the show as a couple of upstarts. Their names were Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart. Some upstarts. But Cohan was so convinced that he knew better than they that each night he drove Hart to distraction by altering the lyrics and substituting his own. As for Rodgers, Cohan was convinced that there wasn't a good melody in the show. Well, how justified was he? Now, here's one of the numbers from I'd Rather Be Right. Cohan hated it.
Have you met Sir Jones? Someone said as we shook hands, he was just Sir Jones to me. said, Sir Jones. You're a boy who understands. I'm a girl who must be free. And all at once I lost my breath, and all at once was scared to death. And all at once I owned the earth and sky. Now I've met Sir Jones, and we'll keep on meeting.
Have you met Miss Jones, or in that case, have you met Sir Jones in the Ella Fitzgerald version, wasn't good enough for Georgie Cohan, but posterity has settled for it happily enough. But perhaps we shouldn't be too hard on Georgie for being so intractable. After all, times had changed, and the old standards, which still seemed good enough for him, had been left a long way behind. We can see that when we hear once again the most famous of the George Cohan songs. Had written Over There back in 1917, when the United States finally entered the Great War, and its popularity was so enormous that in 1936, President Roosevelt gave Cohan a medal in recognition. Today, the medal hangs on the wall at Cohan's beloved Lambs Club, one of several gradually fading symbols of one of the most remarkable theatrical careers in American history. George Cohan died on November the 5th, 1942, in New York City. Playwright, lyricist, composer, producer, director, song and dance man, star. The man who created our image of what Broadway was, or at least what it should have been. The man who praised himself because he wouldn't trust anyone else to do the job properly. Well, let's leave George M. Cohan with the closing speech which he used all his life to wind up a performance, and which has become a cherished part of showbiz folklore. It's perhaps the best way to take our farewell of this most remarkable, often difficult, always interesting man, George M. Cohan.
And I'm going to make that speech now. And I don't think I'm out of order making. Because spiritually, I really think that my father thanks you, my mother thanks you, my sister thanks you, and as for myself, that goes without saying. Now, there's another speech that I've made for the past 25 years, every chance I got to make it. And a few years after I concocted this thing, I found a place for it in a play. And it kind of sums up my idea, my outlook on life. And I think that most any sensible man feels the same way about it. And this is the speech. I don't know who I am, and if I knew, I'd be the most miserable man on earth. But my greatest happiness lies in the fact that I occupy a unique position. For I have never been cast for a part in this great world drama of life. I am a lonely, single-handed spectator. I'm sitting back, looking on and laughing. I'm laughing at the monkey shines of the great all-star company of millions and millions of men and women who are unknowingly playing the piece for me. I am the audience. And if I may say so, I'm a highly intellectual audience. For in all the changing scenes of this ever-beginning, never-ending, plotless plot, I recognize the spiritual hand of a great director, a master dramatist who has so skillfully staged this tightly woven, disconnected spectacle of tragic nonsense. And so I am amused, and I laugh, and I applaud. And if I am any critic, this is a bully good play. One of these days, I hope to meet the author and to compliment him for this marvelous entertainment. Now, alas, there is no one with whom I may discuss the merits of this very wonderful play, because the rest are on the stage. I'm sitting out front alone, all alone. Do you follow me? I hope you do, because that's the end of my speech.
Thank you. And there we have to leave George M. Cohan, the American showman, and Michael Craig for a further week. The programme was written by Benny Green and researched by Bill Sullivan. The producer was David Rayburn Allen. Next week, Michael Craig introduces the first of two programmes on Alexander Cohen. And here now is Benny Green to say a few words on that subject. But first, a postscript on this evening's programme.
So that was George Michael Cohan, the most versatile of all the showmen, the most difficult to handle, one of the hardest to like, the one who was, more than any of the others, impossible to ignore and impossible to forget. The modern world can't possibly produce his equal, because since the naive days when Cohan emerged, the various jobs in the theatre have become so much more specialised that nobody any longer can even dream of doing what Cohan did. Next week we'll meet the modern article, a businessman rather than a performer, but a man who understands performers. Also, a man who in his own very different, more modern way is just as unusual as Cohan. When we come to Alexander Cohen, we meet for the first time the transatlantic impresario, the operator with one foot in New York and the other in London. And Cohen is distinctive for another reason, the style of the productions for which he first became famous. A cynic might even have said they weren't productions at all, so much as elaborate concerts or even recitals. Alex Cohen, graduating from the tight percentages of the agency world, went into the management side of things as a purveyor of a special kind of entertainment, the one-man or one-woman show. Now, perhaps that's a slight exaggeration, because the first hit he had in London was a two-man show, and the biggest hit, a four-man show. But the thing he was good at was presenting a tiny cast doing its own thing in a very specialised, often eccentric context.
Some people like a motorbike, some say a tram for me, or for Bonnie,
or me lorry.
They lay them down and D. Such means of locomotion seem rather dull to us, the driver and conductor of a London omnibus. Oh, but it ain't please ting-ting. Oh, but it ain't please ting-ting. When you are lost in London and you don't know where you are, you'll hear my voice a-calling both further down the car. And very soon you'll find yourself inside the terminus in a London transport diesel engine 97 horsepower omnibus. Along the Queen's Great Highway, I drive my merry-goes at 20 miles per hour in the middle of the road.
We like to drive in convoys, we're most gregarious. The big six-wheeler's scarlet painted a London transport diesel engine 97 horsepower omnibus.
The test or anything to show more fair.
Fair.
When cabbies try to pass me before they overtake, I sticks me flipping hand out and I jams on all me brakes.
Them jackal taxi drivers can only swear and cuss behind that monarch of the road,
observer of the highway code.
That big six wheeler,
scarlet painted,
a London transport
diesel engine,
97 horsepower omnibus.
I stops when I'm requested, although it spoils the ride, so we can shout.
Get out of it, we'll fall right up inside.
We don't ask much for wages, we only want fair shares.
So cut down all the stages
and stick up all the fares.
If tickets cost a pound a piece,
why should you make a fuss?
It's worth it just to ride inside.
30 foot long by 10 foot wide.
Inside that modern cup that
observer of the highway code.
That big six-wheeler, scarlet painted London transport diesel engine.
97 horsepower. 97 horsepower omnibus.
Hold for it, please.
When Alex Cohen dropped his hat on Michael Flanners and Donald Swan, he was pushing a certain style of entertainment, a kind of musical miniature. And although he was later to depart from this sort of thing in search of more ambitious work, this was the kind of show, where the cast can all go home in one taxi, that he became famous for. Now, people don't do certain things just for no particular reason. Alex Cohen made himself a one-man showman because that's what he was good at. He had a kind of knack for organising that kind of production, for pruning it down to its essentials and making it lean and spare with no flab. His wife, Hildy Parks, noticed that.
I think the thing that he's always been attracted to is, I guess, what you call the concert thing, this concept that he started here of the 9 o'clock theatre, which opened actually with Michael Flanders, and Donald Swann and At the Drop of a Hat, and then was followed by Beyond the Fringe and then The Drop of Another Hat and Yves Montand and Marlene Dietrich and Maurice Chevalier, people of that sort. He's always been able to get along terribly well with individual artists. He relates to the material so well. He's a very good editor of that particular kind of material. Good Evening, for instance, was successful in England, but nowhere near what it has been here. And I think that the difference was made by Alex's contribution as a weeder and a pruner and a selector and an organizer. I guess he likes it better because he has a definite contribution to make. He doesn't have that kind of contribution to make, say, to a musical. He probably does tend to the concert thing for that reason.
In the end, of course, Alex Cohen did acquaint himself with the very specialized nightmares of the full-scale show. And when he did, he usually managed to get himself involved in projects which were so unusual as to be original in themselves. Not just musicals, but musical departures. It was Alex Cohen, for instance, who decided to tangle with the genial impossibilities of those two mad clowns, Olsen and Johnson. Even more courageous, Alex Cohen, who dared to put onto the stage the most loved fictitious Englishman in the entire history of the world. Not only put him on stage, but persuade him to sing and dance. Next week, in the first of two programmes devoted to this very imaginative showman, we'll hear the case argued by Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and columnist Rady Harris. Alex Cohen himself will explain in detail what it was like working with great and sometimes unpredictable solo artists like Maurice Chevalier, Victor Borger and Sir John Gielgud. And we'll hear the singing voices of performers like Louis Armstrong, Yves Montand, Richard Burton and Lena Horne. Most of all, we'll be hearing the voice of that immortal fictitious detective, who was taken up one day by Alexander Cohen and persuaded to become a song and dance man. Who would ever have conceived a syncopated Sherlock Holmes?
And it's so simple, sublimely simple, if you learn not just to see, but to observe. Put your brain to work, not just the optic nerve. If you put your mind to use, you will find the most abstruse.
You see, it's simple, absurdly simple. It's as obvious as 2 and 2 make 4.
Rudimentary deduction, nothing more.
Though at first we were impressed, we see now that Edith's face is all so simple.
It's more than simple. It's the very essence of simplicity.
No, we cannot disagree.
For as any fool can see,
it's all so simple. Oh, yes, it's simple.
Simple, easy, nothing. Basic, child's play,
plainly as evidence can be.
It's elementary.
Benny Green was looking ahead to next week's American Showman.